Hello and welcome to Literary Italy. Follow us on Facebook at Literary Italy, on Instagram at Literary Italy Podcast, and on Twitter at Literary Italy. Our website address is www.literaryitaly.com. Our email address is mail@literaryitaly.com. We love hearing from listeners. Now, if you enjoy our podcast, please subscribe or follow us using your podcast app. That will really help us. Also, please consider giving us a 5-star review at Apple Podcasts, at Spotify, at Google, at Stitcher, or wherever you're getting this podcast. Spread the word. Today, we've got something special. We've got an interview. Our guest today is Jay Malarche. Jay is the associate professor, and program director of theater history and criticism at West Virginia University. Also, he first introduced Anne and me to each other many, many years ago at St. John's College, so we owe him a lot. He's a dramaturge, a director, actor, and a great friend of the show. He's also a very funny guy. Anne and I reflected on a performance we saw a few years ago of Carlo Goldoni's Servant of Two Masters. We knew Jay would be the perfect person to talk about with this. He's graciously agreed to an interview, and we hope you enjoy it. Thanks.
Oh, that's Janet. Oh, we're recording.
I like your voice. Is she unattached?
She's attached to my laptop.
Okay, well, there you go.
Don't tell her.
Hello, Jay.
Hey, Jay.
Hi. Good to be with you.
Yeah, good to be with you, too.
On this Literary Italy excursion.
Jay, why don't you just say a little bit about who you are and how we met and how you do what you do.
Okay. My name is Jay Malarche. I'm a PhD in theater history, lit, and crit. I met Jim and Anne at St. John's College, where two of us were doing our masters and one was doing an undergrad, and I'll leave that to your family history to decide who was who. And I directed them in Love's Labor's Lost, and I brought them together, and they blame me annually for that. No, I decided to get my PhD in theater after St. John's because when you have that broad education, it really makes you think about what of all the options in your life you have, where you want to put your energy. And to me, theater combined all the great things I loved, ideas and creativity and showing off. And so I basically got a good deal back at LSU in Louisiana, where I was born, and got my PhD, became a dramaturg, which means I do research for theatrical productions. I also work with foreign language translations and adaptations. I've got Latin and Greek. I was a Russian major, a German minor. I took Italian. I took, I know enough Chinese to get me in trouble. I could tell
you
the
know enough to get yourself out of trouble.
No, I could tell the waitress I love her and I want chopsticks, you know, basically.
Yeah, her husband will love that.
Well, you know, so anyway, I did my dissertation on Larry Gelbart, who is the mastermind behind, most people know him from TV's MASH, created by Larry Gelbart, but he also wrote the movie Tootsie, he wrote Oh God, he wrote for Sid Caesar in his heyday, he wrote for Bob Hope. He basically had a career that stretched from the 40s when he was in high school, if you can believe that, you know, all the way until when he died in 2009. So I did my dissertation on him, and it was like a graduate program in comedy. And so comedy has been my life's work since then. And really before that, when I was just a class clown, right? So the topic I want to talk about today, though, is the commedia aspects of Literary Italy, because it is as sort of wide and broad as sort of the different regions of Italy itself. So, you know, you could talk about, a literary home base for, you know, Machiavelli in Florence, or, you know, as we'll talk about Goldoni and Gozzi in Venice, and Dante in the lumbar region, which is the lower back, I believe. And you know, everybody sort of has a regional hero in literature. And the nice thing about Commedia is that all the characters are drawn from the different parts of Italy, so that everybody would recognize, oh, that's a Neapolitan guy, or, you know, Arlecchino is from Bergamo. The Dottore is from probably a university town like Bologna. Pantalone, the old merchant, is from Venice, of course, because Venice is known for their merchants. So that's how they kind of spread the wealth around Italy. But the characters themselves date back to the Greek New Comedy and ancient Roman comedy. So it's really a long-standing tradition.
What sort of timeline are we talking about?
Did you
as distinct from these earlier things you're talking about? You're mentioning the Greek stuff.
So I didn't quite catch the whole question.
Oh, maybe my question is when do we see? We're talking about Commedia, the things we're going to be reading it from, like the 1700s.
Right. Well, that's, you know, Commedia is a Renaissance art form.
Okay.
And if you think about the fall of Rome, right? We all know about that. It was in all the papers. The fall of Rome pretty much cut out all institutional theater in Europe. It was devastating to the sort of the standing traditions that the Greeks and the Greco-Roman theater had. So what happens is that you start having these roving bands of actors and entertainers, right? Kind of the troubadour tradition you might think of in Northern Europe. Well, in Italy, it became these farce players, these actors who would go into a town. They juggle, they do magic tricks, they do plays in the piazza without any kind of needing a theater building. They'd attract a crowd, they'd pass the hat, and they'd make their money that way. And that's the real root in the 1400s of what we would call the Commedia dell'arte, which is literally the professional comedy. You know, arte there meaning the artisan comedy. You know, they could charge more because it's artisan, like for a loaf of bread, it's artisan. So Commedia dell'arte doesn't mean...
It sort of regrows out of like a street performance, essentially.
Yes, yes. And it's not written down. There's a separate tradition called Commedia erudite, which means literary comedy or erudite comedy. And that's what Machiavelli actually wrote. He has a very famous play called Il Mandragola, which I read with my students against the prince. And it's amazing how the political theories of Machiavelli, the idea that the end justifies the means and,
yes,
you know, it's better to be feared than loved and all those things. They enter into this comedy. It's a sex farce, the Mandrake.
Yeah, we did an episode.
Okay.
Again,
so think of that as, that's exactly what erudite means. It means it's scripted. All the jokes are there. The actors are in an indoor theater probably because it's for the count or the duke in the city, so it's very much an upper class kind of comedy. Now, Commedia dell'arte is not scripted. That's the real difference. It's improvisational, and it starts with a number of set characters or masks, they're called. So the mask itself applies not just to the physical appliance for the face, but it's also that character. So you could say, I do four masks, meaning I can play four different types of characters. You know, I can be a Pantalone, I can be a Brighella, I can be a Arlecchino, you know, that sort of thing. And each one of those masks is distinct. You know, Pantalone has the long nose and Arlecchino has the kind of the big round cheeks and the kind of the gleeful eyes. So the masks are the signal to the audience that this is a servant, this is a master, this is a middle-class guy, this is, you know, the only ones who didn't wear masks in the Commedia dell'arte tradition were the innamorati, the lovers. So the young male romantic lead and the young female romantic lead, they didn't wear masks. They had natural beauty. So fast forward from the Commedia dell'arte being just improvisational scenarios done on the spur of the moment where, you know, they might huddle up before the show and say, okay, you're going to be, you know, the father you want your daughter to marry, your business partner's son, but she wants to marry the guy who's been serenading her with his guitar outside the balcony. And we find out at the end, it's the partner's son who's been serenading her. Happy ending all around.
Right.
You know, this is what the Greek comedy calls the gamos, meaning the wedding or the marriage that brings the sides together in an improvement for the next generation, which is a very comedic tradition. So they would do that scenario. They would say, okay, everybody got their ideas, the roles. Okay, break, let's do the show. And they would just improvise the lines to make the show work. And then they would have things that were built in, little modular pieces of business, which the Yiddish call shtick, but which the Italians call lazzi. And lazzi are preformed comedic moments that they could insert into almost any play in any, you know, if they have a down moment, if they need to wait for a costume change or whatever, they could just throw in this piece. It's very similar to what we think of in the Three Stooges tradition of the, you know, the nyuk-nyuk or the curling going whoop, 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 whoop. They could do that whether they're plumbers or caterers or bankers or, you know, whatever they're pretending to be in that episode.
Can I just interrupt for a second and for our listeners indicate that you did, in fact, put your hand up between your eyes and then move two fingers between.
Somebody had to do it. Right. You weren't going to do it, Jim.
No, but that needs to be narrated because people can't see it. That's why.
Okay. Well, yes, I can do physical comedy as long as it's an audio-only recording.
I'm not a podcast.
Yes. So, in fact, I'm light on my feet in podcasts. We fast forward about 200 years to the 18th century. And by this time, commedia has actually migrated in that time to France. And the Comédie Italienne became a very, very important theater in Paris. It's where Molière cut his teeth. So if you look at Molière's theater, it's very much building on these characters like the miser, right?
Right.
And the father marrying off the daughter to the man he wants, like in The Imaginary Invalid. I want my daughter to marry a doctor so I get free medical advice, right?
Right.
So that's very comedian. Now, in the 18th century in Venice, two men, Carlo Goldoni and Carlo Gozzi, both Carlos, were rivals to resurrect the real commedia tradition. But they did it each in a different way. Goldoni chose the more middle-class storyline of commedia, and Gozzi chose the more fantastic, magical side. So it's almost as if, you know, you have two children and each one takes after a different parent or different aspect of the parent. So what Goldoni wrote in his celebrated plays like The Servant of Two Masters or The Mistress of the Inn, what he wrote was basically a farce about confused dedication or confused work, which is a very middle-class thing. Gozzi wrote about transformation, like a king that's turned into a stag. Il Re Cervo is the name of his greatest play, I think. He also wrote one called Turandot, about a princess that became a Puccini opera, right? So if you think about what we have in Venice at this time in the 18th century, commedia is not really being performed in the streets anymore. And nobody really looks at it as the thing. It's kind of fallen out of favor. So these two men on their own and kind of in conflict or in some sort of a rivalry, try to resurrect what they think commedia should be. And when Goldoni, who studied Molière, who came 100 years before, when he was writing his plays, like Servant of Two Masters, he would write a line or he'd write a scene and he'd say, oh, it's good, but it's not Molière. And he would scratch through it and he would write better. So that was a very, very, very important tell on Goldoni's part, that he saw himself in the tradition, not only of commedia, the Italian tradition, but Molière's innovations and Molière's genius. And he would write, what would Molière do in this situation? Very similar to what Billy Wilder would do when he was writing his screenplays. He had a sign in his office, the director of Some Like It Hot and, Double Indemnity and all these great movies. He had a sign in his office that said, how would Lubitsch do it? Because he loved Ernst Lubitsch's films. So the idea of learning a commedia tradition is not just passed on from master to apprentice, but also passed on from genius to genius, in the case of Molière to Goldoni or Lubitsch to Billy Wilder. It's part of what makes theater such a strong art form, because you don't just decide, I'm going to be commedia. You have to study the history, and you have to learn how to make your own mask. It's almost like a rite of passage. You can't play the character until you get that mask right. And so if you go to Italy now, if you go to, almost any major city, I was in Parma, and there's a puppetry museum there, which is great, but they also have a strong commedia tradition there. And you can study with a master who will teach you how to make the mask out of leather, and once you put a mask on, this is something that a lot of non-actors don't realize. Once you put a mask on, it forces you to communicate more through your body, because the facial expressions don't communicate to the audience, right? Yeah. Do you see how that works? So that you become much more of a physical clown,
right?
And you have to use your body to sort of amplify the emotion or amplify the reaction. And this makes better actors. So when you do take off your mask, you now have your body tuned in and your face, and you're that much stronger. I should say that the greatest American clown at the moment is a guy named Bill Irwin.
Oh, yeah.
And if you know Bill Irwin's work, you know that he is very much a body in motion. And for your listeners, if you want to get a taste of Bill Irwin, The Regard of Flight is a wonderful sort of expose of all of his interests, including commedia. He does a whole scene of Arlecchino. So it becomes, a great continuance of the tradition in Bill Irwin's work. The Regard of Flight is the name of that. And you might even want to link it in the
show notes. Sure,
that sounds great. So back to Goldoni and Gozzi in Venice. Now, Venice is, as you know, a real sort of hub of culture. And the beauty of the Venetians is that, well, one thing, in the commedia tradition, they were the butt of jokes. If somebody couldn't ride a horse, they were from Venice, because, of course, Venetians don't have a lot of experience riding horses. So it's kind of an in-joke that, if somebody's not a good horseman, it's like, oh, well, he must be from Venice kind of thing. But what Goldoni used was this Venetian father figure who is somewhat of a miser. Sort of the Simpsons, Mr. Burns is the continuation of that character, right? With the long nose. I mean, he's almost got a mask on himself, Mr. Burns. And the idea that Goldoni is using this merchant character to set his daughter up with someone suitable. Again, this is that kind of modern, I'm using modern in quotes, father, right? Who's saying, you're going to marry the man I want you to, but I do want you to love him too. It's not just a forced marriage. So a lot of what Goldoni's doing is he's moving the commedia from a Renaissance art form into a middle class, what would you call that? Enlightenment almost, the 18th century, we're right on the cusp of the Enlightenment. In fact, Gozzi's play Turandot was adapted by Schiller in Germany into a romantic play. And of course, Puccini's opera being very romantic in its own right. But the idea that there was a lot of crosstalk among traditions, so that the German neoclassical or even the Sturm und Drang, you know, authors knew about the commedia types. Austria had its own commedia type servant called Hans Wurst, which is sometimes translated into British English as Jack Pudding. So Hans Wurst is this kind of, you know, know-nothing bumpkin who gets into trouble, but also ends up having a solution that'll save the day. And that brings us back to this servant character. In The Servant of Two Masters, a lot of people probably don't realize that the title is drawn from
the Bible.
From Matthew, right. No man can be the servant of two masters. And so Goldoni wrote a play that basically sets out to prove that. You know, you can't be a servant of two masters and do both well.
So maybe this is a good place to give listeners kind of a quick synopsis or a précis on the play itself.
Well, okay. Now that's almost impossible. Basically, no, seriously, it is so convoluted that it turns into a tongue twister. Basically, you've got a woman who pretends to be her dead brother to get the dowry. And then they're not
married. The man she wants to marry.
Right. So she can marry
the man. Was engaged to the daughter.
Clarice, right.
Of Pantalone.
And so that's enough for a play right there. But you've got people coming back from the dead, so to speak, you know, people showing up unexpectedly. And the title character, Truffaldino, is the servant of two masters. And he is in that Arlecchino quality. He is what we call in commedia terms a zani, where we get the English word zany from, Z-A-N-Y. Comes from zani, which is a Neapolitan slang for a Johnny. Okay, so Johnny Zani is like anybody, you know, Joe Blow.
Right.
So the Zani became this kind of class of characters who were kind of your servants, some of whom are wily servants, like out for their own gain, which Truffaldino certainly is. But most of the time, they're just looking for their next meal.
Right.
Which Truffaldino also is.
Right.
Exactly.
He's going to play both sides so he can get
right.
Meals.
Exactly. Because he's always hungry. And that's again, a running joke about servants. And if you remember in Il Mandragola, the parasite character, Ligurio, he's there to make some money and get some free meals.
Right.
He's there to help. And the parasite character, again, dates back to the ancient Greek comedy. So the idea of Truffaldino being this kind of Arlecchino, which the French transformed into Arlequin, right? Like Harlequin romances, is usually depicted in motley, which is that diamond, multicolored costume, diamond pattern. Whereas in France, you have a clown like Pierrot, who is most often in a white, fully white, to show his kind of naivete and innocence. But Truffaldino is in the motley, which is in some way symbolic of the fact that he is a chameleon. He can be any color at any time, whatever you need to focus on. And that's why he is such a great character to be the servant of two masters, because ultimately he does make things work until they don't. They screw up, but in such a way that the right ending comes about, which is, again, one of the hallmarks of commedia. You have that gamos. So we have like two or three marriages set up in the happy ending of this play.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Even Truffaldino gets Smeraldina,
yes.
Right?
He gets the servant girl, right?
He gets his babe, yeah. And you know, and that's always you know, if you know A Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Forum, which Larry Gelbart also wrote, it's based on those Roman comedy characters. But if you think about it, one of the great things about it at the end is Pseudolus gets a girl from one of the courtesans next door. So the idea that the servant gets a little love action is a nice touch in these plays.
You mentioned Gozzi. So and Turandot. One of the things that, as we were talking before this, that kind of piqued my curiosity you said Goetze should be better known than Goldoni. Do you want to talk a little bit about that?
Well, it's a matter of taste.
Yeah.
I find that Goldoni tends toward the bourgeois, whereas Goetze plays up the fantastical magic of theater that would appeal to kids. You can use a lot of puppets in his plays. I'll give you an example, the King's Stag, which is the one I know the best. He also wrote a play called The Love for Three Oranges, which Prokofiev, the Russian composer, right, made into an opera. But the King's Stag is about this king who needs to marry his daughter off. And he has this special bust statue in his household that smiles when anyone lies in front of it, whenever they tell an untruth. So he's got this piece of plaster or marble that smiles. So there's the magic.
Nice.
And he brings all the suitors in, and he says, "Why do you want to marry my daughter?" And every one of the men says, "Oh, I love your daughter. I think she's marvelous. I'd marry her without a dowry." And the statue always smiles. And so that's part of the fun. It's kind of a fairy tale in that regard, right? Uh-huh. And then the king goes on a hunt, and he's transformed by prime minister, the evil prime minister, into turning into a stag. And at the hunt, the king is killed by an arrow. But because he's a transformed character, he can come back to life. It's you gotta accept a lot of this as a given. But it's such a beautiful thing. And you can imagine what an audience of children would love to see, the almost like the way the Lion King uses those animal puppets on stage.
Right.
You could do that with the stag. I mean, it's just, it gives a lot more opportunity for creative development. Now, if I were an actor, Goldoni would probably be my choice, because then I could put all my acting training to use in the Commedia mask. But I think, looking at the broad storytelling, I think Goetze has a lot of fun to exploit there.
Yeah, the thing that struck me as we were reading Servant of Two Masters, and we saw a performance of it probably about 5 years ago.
Maybe a little less.
Maybe a little
less. It was definitely pre-pandemic.
Yeah, but one of the things that strikes me is all the opportunities. First of all the asides to the audience. Like
those
beautiful little moments of,
yeah,
hey, I think I'm getting away with this. What do you guys think?
Right.
And that, I just see, that basically
it
allows
evolves.
You, gives you license to...
Sure. Breaking the fourth wall there is a lot of fun. And again, that comes out of street playing, right?
Yes.
There's no proscenium arch to create this barrier between the audience and the performers. You're kind of mixed among them. Now, the cool thing, besides the asides in the Servant of Two Masters, is that it's been adapted and updated 10 years ago into One Man, Two Governors, with James Corden, the talk show host and actor.
Right.
He played a kind of a Cockney servant in Brighton Beach. And it's the same principal story with a few, updated twists and turns. But, basically he's hungry. He's like, I think in that story, he's an out of work skiffle band washboard player. He's like, I haven't eaten in days because nobody wants me, to do my gig. And so there's a famous Lotzi in Servant of Two Masters where he's got to seal the letter.
Yes.
So he takes a bit
my grandmother's old trick.
Yeah. Take a piece of bread, you chew it up until it becomes paste, and you seal the letter. But now you tell the listeners what happens every time he puts that piece of bread in his mouth.
He has to eat it.
Yeah, he swallows it because he's hungry.
He's hungry.
He can't help himself. So that's one of the famous Lotzi that are just sort of inserted into that moment.
Right.
Nice.
Another famous Lotzi is the fly landing on your partner's head, and you slap the fly and the partner thinks you're slapping him upside the head, right? I mean, you've seen that how many dozen of times in your life? Those date all the way back maybe to the Greeks, because they had flies. It's a news item. The Greeks had flies.
I was going to say maybe cavemen.
Yeah, exactly.
Oog, oog, fly.
Fly bad. And then they had clubs there. So it's not just happening.
It's like, which is a lot funnier.
Yeah,
it's like beating them senseless. Now that's probably
all these cave paintings are. They're just comedy.
Right, exactly. This is how to do this, Lotsy. This is how to do this, Lotsy. Yeah, and in Germany, this is shtick. Hit them with a shtick.
You know, one of the questions I had was, as Jim said, we saw a production of this play a couple of years ago put on by the Shakespeare Theater of New Jersey. And uh-huh. At some point, probably about 5 years ago, when I was looking for a play to do with a high school group, this really came up. I think it is actually, this particular one, Servant of Two Masters, seems to be maybe being performed a little bit more, maybe rising in popularity along the lines, you know, people who have already done Midsummer Night's Dream, but they want something, you know, pretty much G-rated. They want it funny. They want it slapstick so that the whole family can enjoy it. But I do wonder, just because it doesn't seem like we have a whole lot of Goldoni in English translation. And I wonder,
one of the things I do as a dramaturg is if a director's saying, I want to do Servant of Two Masters, they'll come to me and say, what's the most workable English translation?
Yeah.
So I'll look at the Italian, such as my Italian is, and I'll look at the English translation. I'll see who's the most literal, who's the most sort of adaptive as opposed to translative. Mm-hmm. And I'll say, this one's honors the tradition more. This one has some funny new things that the adapter put in. So, you know, you can't really... Unless you have the Italian, you can't tell who's the most, honoring of Goldoni's original, you know, that sort of thing. But I do want to mention also that, yeah, Servant of Two Masters is sort of G-rated. And because it's written down as a script, it's not asking for the improvisational skills of the children actors in the high school.
Sure.
Right? Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So if you were to say, we're gonna write our own commedia play about, I don't know, high school prom night or something, right?
Yeah.
You know, you if you had students who were really skilled, they could come up with something very funny and entertaining. But you can't count on that in a limited rehearsal time with limited training for the students. You need something that's kind of foolproof. And that's what Servant of Two Masters provides. It also doesn't require the technical budget or skill of puppeteering for a Gozzi play, right? I mean, Servant of Two Masters is basically this guy maybe in coveralls, you know, you don't even have to do period costumes. Put him in coveralls, you know, give him a ladder that he's carrying around, you know, with a paint bucket on each end so he can't put it down safely, you know, that sort of thing, you know, and then go from there. Because Goldoni has written the situations into the play already. All you have to do then is to inhabit that character with or without a mask. You don't even have to do Goldoni with a mask.
Right.
It's great to teach the students with masks, but, you know, the audience may not get as much out of it as the students. If I were doing it in a high school, I would probably say, we're going to spend the first week and a half of rehearsals using masks. And then we're going to drop the masks and see what that does to our characterizations. Yeah. Because that way they get a taste of the tradition, but you're not forcing it on the audience with less than skilled, you know, participants.
Right. And also that way you're working on using your whole body to perform.
Exactly. You get all those benefits.
Right.
And also you help the students to see that they're part of a tradition, that they're not just putting on a play because you decided that plays are good. No, plays have always been there in our culture. It's who decides to, you know, put their energies into moving the art form forward, or to honor the traditions, as with, you know, Goldoni and Gozzi honoring the commedia traditions.
That's great. So should I do more translations of Goldoni? I mean, does the world need more English translations, or is it just a supply and demand and the demand?
You know, this is one of those things. A good translation is always welcomed. especially if it's a verse play and you can do verse translation. I just, with my lit class, I just did Cyrano de Bergerac. And we use the Anthony Burgess translation, which is in rhymed couplets.
Right.
And it's gorgeous. And I would pity anyone who read Cyrano in a prose translation, right? Because the whole point is that it's poetry. Life is poetry. So the same thing applies to Goldoni. You want to capture his idiom in the English. And you don't have to go all the way to making him a Cockney or whatever.
Right.
But if you know the neighborhood that he's from, right? And, you know, Arlecchino is from Bergamo or Bergamo, you know, and it becomes this question of, you know, what are those qualities of people from that area near Milan that everybody else in Italy would recognize?
Right.
That's
right.
Really tuning into the sort of the subtext and the character within the character in a lot of these commedia pieces. And I mentioned before we started, or maybe as we started, that, you know, I directed y'all in Love's Labor's Lost. And there's a couple of characters, you know, the Don Armado is the yes. braggart warrior, right?
Yes.
He, and you know, Costard, who's the clown, is typically Truffaldino or Arlecchino.
I was going to say, he could totally be Truffaldino, right?
Yeah. And so, it, and you even have, like, Don Armado's little parasite, Moth, I think it is. Or is Moth with...
Moth is with Costard.
Yes, but there's also Jacquinetta, who's kind of the Smeraldina, right. You know.
Yes.
So, so this is interesting because Shakespeare is writing in the late 1500s, early 1600s. He knows the Italian tradition, and he's not beholden like Molière to a neoclassical theater, where you have to have one set, you know, one, you know, unity of time and place, and all those French unities. Shakespeare could go all over the place. So he could create A Midsummer Night's Dream, which you can imagine how offensive that would be to the French neoclassicists, you know, because it's got things that, that, you know, bugger verisimilitude. And all of a sudden you've got a very entertaining piece. I think Voltaire in the 18th century went to see a revival of a Shakespeare play in London and wrote back that it was the most barbaric thing he'd ever seen. You know, so again, it's about taste, right? And so, you know, bringing it back to Goldoni and Gozzi, do you lean more toward theater as an expression of imagination? Then you're a Gozzi. If you look at it as kind of a comedy that everyone can relate to, then you're a Goldoni. I mean, that's really what it comes down to in my mind. And I know that's an oversimplification and generalization. So, you know, don't shoot me down for that. But it's a good starting point to study the differences. And if you go to Venice, you will see the Commedia tradition represented in people hawking Commedia masks on the bridges and the little stalls. And there's a Casa di Goldoni to visit.
Yes,
little,
so that was my, we were going to segue into visiting Venice. So there's the Casa di Goldoni.
Yeah.
There's also the Goldoni Theater, which is...
Yeah. Yeah.
It predates him, but it's now called the Goldoni Theater because that's where it is. And that idea of, rather than, as you were saying, street performance, you have a fixed a theater that stays there, you know, that you're not dismantling it, you know, kind of, I guess, in the same way in London at the Globe.
And one of the cool things to tie all of this theater history together is if you go to the... you go to Parma, the Teatro Farnese. It's one of the first proscenium houses in Europe. It was bombed out during World War II, but they rebuilt it. And you see how they use a perspective scenery. And if you think about Renaissance painting, this is the birth of that single point or, you know, multi-point perspective. Whereas, you know, one of the things, if you look at, if you look at the Middle Ages, their theater, which is very sparse, is very much like a passion play, where you move from one mansion to another. Each scene is in a different location around either the city center or the church, right? The Stations of the Cross is basically different mansions from a medieval telling. And if you think about medieval painting, you've got that simultaneity of actions where you might have Jesus being born in the corner and being right. crucified in the other corner and other parables being displayed.
Right.
It's all taking place in one moment and there's no perspective. In the Renaissance, you know, you've got this innovation that makes the interior setting of a cityscape like Servant of Two Masters a perfect use of that perspective scenery in a proscenium theater. The only problem is you can't go too far upstage or the perspective makes you as tall as the building. You know, that's one of the risks. You have to sort of stay lateral, which in Commedia, there's a really great Commedia piece that Molière wrote called Scapin, or Scapino in Italian. And who was it? Jim Dale, who did a bunch of comedies in the 80s. Jim Dale did a play called Scapino, which is an updated version of Scapin. And there's a famous scene where the guy puts his boss into a sack because these thugs are looking for him. And the thugs say, "What's in the sack?" He goes, "Nothing, nobody." And he says, "Well, is your master in the sack?" He says, "If my master was in the sack, would I be hitting it with this stick?" You know, and he just beats the shit out of his master. Can I say that? He beats the hell out of the master. And then the master gets out when the thugs leave and thanks him for not, you know.
Wait, that's
a
Bugs Bunny.
That's exactly what I was going to say. Bugs Bunny, you know, when Edward G. Robinson's like, hide me, and he puts him in the oven, right?
Right,
and he
right.
turns up
Would
the
I
gas.
Would I do this?
Would I do this? So clearly, one of the things I try to teach my students about these traditions is that if you don't know what happened in the past, you're cutting yourself off from a lot of good material and a lot of solutions to problems you will hit in production, right? In other words, the way to do Servant of Two Masters is to know the way to do Servant of Two Masters. There's, you know, it's sort of like a kind of a tautology, but the idea is you can't do Servant of Two Masters like a Wagnerian opera, right? I mean, it's not going to work, and you can't do it. You can't even do it like a Neil Simon play. You have to do it like an episode of Frasier or something. You know, Frasier was a great farce series. Almost every episode involved, you know, pretending to be something you're not, or right. hiding someone, mistaken identity. All those things are part of the Commedia tradition of farce.
Yeah, that's right. And yeah, same with Servant. So it is a kind of situation comedy.
Exactly. And you know, later Italian writers like Dario Fo,
yeah,
you know, he's very much a clown performing in a situation like his Accidental Death of an Anarchist, which is a play I teach, is just brilliant. And it pulls from a lot of these Lazzi in the Commedia tradition.
Yeah.
Because they please the audience. The audience can be, you know, sort of second guessing the plot or even ahead of the plot, which is kind of a bad thing. But if they're out of whack with the plot, a Lazzi can actually align people into the flow of the plot a little better. You know, you pull in a couple of nice moments. The kids are happy. They're not, you know, they're not shifting in the seats next to you because they're bored. All of a sudden they see a guy pretending to be a dog to chase a dog away. Or so, you know, all of a sudden there's something fun that everybody can relate to. And then right. you can get back to the love story.
Right. That's great. We're going to have you back to talk about Dario Fo because yeah. we haven't come.
Oh, I love Fo. Yeah.
That's great.
And I love the soup too.
So for our listeners, the takeaway is to go read The Servant of Two Masters by Carlo Goldoni, The King's Stag by Gozzi, and Everything Else in the Western Canon. Is that right, Jane?
Yeah, you know, and to keep your eye open for Commedia characters yes. when they pop up.
Yes, I think that's a really good point.
Yeah.
And that you'll find them in...
Yeah, I mean, if you watch an old Sergeant Bilko, I mean, he's an Arlecchino. You know, he's a wily servant, right?
Jay,
this was great.
This was really good.
You can have me back anytime. We'll talk about...
Always a pleasure.